The following program is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and was first broadcast in 1984. The World of Islam, Part 3, Muhammad and His Heirs. The life and character of the Prophet Muhammad and the beginning of Islam in Arabia. The program is introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings.
Muslims believe in the same God as Jews and Christians, but they do not believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, rather that he was a great prophet. For Muslims, the last in the line of prophets that begins with Adam and Abraham was Muhammad al-Amin, the faithful one, whom Muslims usually refer to simply as Muhammad, adding in Arabic the words, "May the peace and blessings of God be upon him." For Muslims, Muhammad is not divine, but it was to him that God chose to deliver the final revelation of his message through the Archangel Gabriel. This message was received by Muhammad, who is thought, by the way, to have been illiterate. It was later written down and collected by his first companions into the Quran, or the recitation. In this program, we examine the life and character of this extraordinary man, Muhammad, the last of God's prophets, and how the Muslims decided to continue their community after his death in the year 632. The program is reported and narrated by Julian Crandall Hollick.
Muhammad was born in Mecca around the year 570 in the Quraysh tribe. The Quraysh were responsible for looking after the Kaaba, the house built by Abraham to the worship of God. Muslims believe that Muhammad was descended from Abraham through his eldest son Ismail. Muhammad's early childhood was anything but easy, as Laila Asawi, a schoolteacher in Cairo, Egypt, explains.
When he was born, he was an orphan. His father died. His mother died when he was 6 years old. His grandfather took care of him until he was eight. Then his grandfather died and he lived with his uncle.
From the beginning, Muhammad stood out from other children, according to Sami Alangawi in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
He was very well known since he was a young boy of being different from the others. Almost like, a wise man. And even before he was a prophet, they used to call him Al-Amin, Al-Sadiq, which means the ones who always telling the truth.
We know little about Muhammad's childhood in Mecca. His life becomes better documented when, at the age of 25, he married Khadija, a wealthy and pious widow, 15 years older than Muhammad, and also from the Quraysh. Khadija was running her late husband's business and had hired Muhammad to work for her. Until her death, Muhammad took no other wife, and he was greatly influenced by her high moral principles and virtuous example. Marriage to Khadija allowed Muhammad the leisure to reflect on the spiritual matters that were germinating in his mind. Sami Ayangawi takes up the story.
He used to go away to worship in one of the mountains in Mecca, which is known also now, until he was about 40. Then Gabriel came to him with the verses from the Quran and told him to read, and he said, "I don't read." He said, "Read in the name of God." And eventually he was taught the Quran by Gabriel.
The Archangel Gabriel not only instructed Muhammad to recite and memorize God's final revelation, he also told Muhammad to preach and convert people to its message. Now, the majority of the inhabitants of Mecca were idol worshippers, and Muhammad's insistence on the existence of only one God first annoyed and then threatened them. It wasn't long before many of these idolaters, including members of Muhammad's own family, began to persecute Muhammad's followers and fellow Muslims. Muhammad's claim to have traveled in the space of a single night to Jerusalem and to have prayed there in holy union with all the prophets before ascending to heaven, the celebrated nocturnal journey, provided Muhammad's opponents with ready ammunition to attack his credibility. Sami Alangawi again.
He told them that he has been to Jerusalem last night and he ascended to heaven. So they said, now we got him, he's crazy, you know. They couldn't say he's a liar because he was known always to be an honest man. But then he said, okay, he gathered all of them and described Jerusalem like if he was seeing it at that moment. And those who has been there, they said, yes, that's exactly the description.
For Muhammad, the obvious solution was to leave Mecca for friendlier pastures, 250 miles to the north in Medina, where Jewish leaders were prepared to welcome the fledgling community.
Then his companions, he told them to go to Medina, because from that city he has met some people during the pilgrimage who has accepted him as a prophet. So he sent his companions there, and then later he left. When the situation got very difficult, he left Mecca to Medina. And that day is what we date, the Hijra calendar. That's the movement from Mecca to Medina.
The Hijra is sometimes compared to the exodus of Moses out of Egypt. But in fact, it was a fairly well-planned and uneventful operation spread over several weeks. The Muslim or Hijra calendar began on July the 16th, 622, the day marking the start of the Hijra. It was chosen by Muhammad's first successor and is a lunar calendar of only 354 and a half days. This means that annual rituals such as the Ramadan fast or the Hajj pilgrimage fall at different times according to the Western calendar. The Islamic world officially began its 15th century at the end of 1979. The Hijra proved a turning point in Muhammad's life. He'd left the city of his birth, an embattled prophet. He then entered Medina, the city of his adoption, as an honored leader. However, external attacks did not let up, and Muhammad was quickly forced to become a practical man of politics, organizing the new community in self-defense. Islam was thus quickly transformed from a religion within a state to a state itself. Muhammad himself was both politician and general, often leading his troops into battle and even being wounded in the process. Within 10 years, however, the Muslim community had become militarily strong enough to return in triumph to Mecca.
And they re-established the unity of God, and they cleaned the Kaaba and Mecca from all the idols and all the things which used to go on there, and re-established Mecca and the mosque as the place of worshiping of one God.
In the last 4 years of his life, Muhammad oversaw the consolidation of the Islamic Ummah, or community, in Mecca and Medina. Tribes flocked from all over the Arabian Peninsula to offer their allegiance and convert to the new religion. But in 632, Muhammad unexpectedly fell ill in Medina and died there at the age of 61. Those are the bare biographical outlines of Muhammad's life, but they offer little insight into the man's character. They give few clues as to why God should have selected this man to be the final prophet of God's revelation to man. Now, on the surface, Muhammad differed little from most other men, according to Sami Al-Angawi in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
And he had, of course, a sense of humor. He would joke, he would cry sometime. He would joke with his family. He would play with his children and put them in his shoulder and carry around, run with them and so on. Sometimes he even reported that he has a race with one of his wife.
On one level, Muhammad is very approachable because he shared the same human condition with the same pleasures and disappointments as most of us. As Said Hossein Nasser, an Iranian scholar of Islam, reminds us.
The Prophet was all human from one point of view, in the sense that he participated fully in human existence, that he married, that he had children, that he had neighbors, that he had to rule over a human community, that he suffered the vicissitudes of human existence, such as the loss of his wife, the death of a young child, the death of his closest companions in battle, and also the joys and glories of having the most beautiful grandchildren whom he loved, an incredible daughter, Fatima, was something of a piece of paradise in the family of the Prophet. having had many wives from different tribes, which enabled him to unify the country, and to have also experienced the supreme point of victory of having established a religious order upon the surface of the earth.
While Muhammad himself insisted on his humanity, it was also a rather special humanity, according to Sayyid Hussein Nasr.
Although it has been said by the Prophet himself, I am a human being like the rest of you, ana basharun mithlukum. Throughout the centuries, the Muslims have always added to this saying and remembered, yes, a human being like others, but like a precious jewel among stones.
Now, what is really hidden from this picture is the extraordinary character of Muhammad, which sets him apart from his fellow men. Muhammad's virtues began with a rigorous self-criticism, or inner jihad.
He was severe with himself beyond the ken of our understanding, in the sense that he turned the sharp edge of the sword towards himself. The war of which we always speak, the Prophet fought most of all against himself. He was hard with himself. The foundation of his humility is that he was hard with himself in a way that all his companions understood.
But one quality stands out even above the humbleness and rigorous self-criticism.
And then crowning this inner humility, nothingness, discipline, with this outward generosity, nobility, crowning these, you might say, complements of virtues, of course, the absolute abiding by the truth, the total submission to the truth, the a priori position that the truth took for him in his life throughout all of his days. And those for him were always on the basis, on the foundation of this inner humility, of this outward nobility and charity, which in a sense determined his relationship with the world about him. But these were means of access to the truth, sidq, sadaqah, which was one of the great virtues of the Prophet, to be sadiq, to have the virtue of sidq.
The fact that Muhammad was a married man with wife, children, and friends, of course, makes it easier for ordinary human beings to identify with him. But this humanity also serves a deeper purpose, making Islam's message much more accessible to the unlettered in rural areas of the Third World.
But this was enabled in order to enable Islam to penetrate into everyday life. That is, the virtues of the Prophet, by intermingling with everyday virtues, enable these every virtues to become integrated into the higher mold.
Although most Muslims believe in a direct individual relationship between themselves and God, the relationship of the individual Muslim to the Prophet Muhammad is also very important. Sayyid Hussein Nasr again.
Many people in the West do not realize why Muslims love the Prophet. The love for the Prophet is related to the love of the Prophet for God. No one can love God without loving his Prophet. And the love for the Prophet issues from the fact that the Prophet had a love for God which, in a sense, encompassed his love for all things. The centrality of this love of the Prophet for the divine, and the fact that one of his important titles in Arabic is Habib, the friend, is Habibullah, the friend of God, alludes to this inner love which pulls towards the one, towards the origin, towards Allah.
After Muhammad's death, the Ummah, or Muslim community, soon discovered that there were events and circumstances in their daily lives for which the Quran did not obviously offer guidance. They therefore turned to the example or sunnah of the Prophet's life. And this was written down and preserved in the form of narrative stories known as traditions or hadith. It is from these hadith that we know so much about Muhammad's adult life.
The hadith literally means a saying, an action, or an endorsement, an approval by the Prophet. A report which tells us he said so and so, he did such and such. This was done in his presence, and he did not stop.
Anis Ahmed, a Muslim scholar and activist, living in Islamabad, Pakistan.
All such reports are put together in the hadith literature. And this hadith literature is not something which was suddenly collected by some researchers in 3rd century or 4th century after the Prophet was dead, but it is a literature which has remained continuously in circulation during his lifetime as well as after his death. So hadith is practically any judgments, any declarations, any endorsements, any instructions given by the Prophet, peace be upon him, on the spot to his companions about any issues. That's why hadith literature contains things that deal with personal hygiene, political discussions, international law, things that deal with how to dress yourself, family life, and so on.
Many scholars, some Muslim, the majority Western, have cast doubt on the authenticity of many of these hadith. By some counts, only 2,000 to 3,000 out of a total of anywhere between 30 and 40,000 have been authenticated. The authenticity of the hadith is important today because Muslim conservatives often cite hadith to justify their opposition to innovations sought by more reformist Muslims. With Muhammad's death, Muslims were faced with the dilemma of who would succeed him as Caliph, or deputy of God, the political leader of the Muslim community. There could obviously be no spiritual successor to Muhammad as prophet, because Muhammad was the last of the prophets. Only a daughter, Fatima, survived him. Two sons born to Khadija and another born to a Christian wife, Mary, all died in infancy. Moreover, Arabian chieftains were not automatically hereditary. The Muslims held the problem of leadership in check for a generation after Muhammad's death by selecting from among his earliest surviving supporters and relatives. The first caliph was Abu Bakr, one of the first companions and the father of Aisha, the favorite among the Prophet's wives after the death of Khadija. But Abu Bakr died after just 4 years, to be succeeded by Umar, who is often held up as the example of all the virtues a caliph ought to possess. But Umar was killed, as was the third caliph Uthman, to be succeeded in turn as fourth caliph by Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali. Although personally pious, Ali was a weak political leader. His authority was soon challenged by Muawiyah, the governor of Syria, who seized control of the caliphate and founded the Umayyad dynasty, with Damascus as its capital. The followers of Ali, known as the Shia Ali, or Party of Ali, rebelled against the Umayyads. Hassan and Hussein, Ali's sons and the grandsons of Muhammad, became the focus of opposition to the Umayyads. The notion spread that rightful leadership of the Muslim Ummah belonged with the Prophet's family. Only when the rule of Muhammad's rightful heirs was re-established would true Islam become reality. Ali's followers, the Shias, also believe to this day that spiritual authority in Islam has been passed down through a male succession of imams or spiritual authorities, beginning with the Ali himself. Here is Ismail al-Shati in Kuwait.
But they believe that al-Khilafah should be in Ali family. And they believe that Ali select the man who should be Khalifa after him. For that, they follow about 11 imam.
Here the story becomes complicated because this 11th imam is reported to have died childless.
Since the 11th one didn't have children, they create a story that this man has a child, and this child go in tunnel, and he will appear again and govern the world, all the world, with the peace and equality and Islam. And they are still waiting this child to appear again.
The majority of Shias, known as Twelvers, therefore believe that this 11th Imam had a son whom he occulted or placed in hiding. They believe that one day this hidden Imam will reemerge as Al-Mahdi, or the Messiah. Shia Imams are not equal to the Prophet, but they are held to be the infallible interpreters of the Quran. Shias therefore accept the notion of spiritual authorities or intermediaries in a way that the majority of Muslims, known as Sunni Muslims, do not. As Fatih Osman, the Egyptian-born editor of Arabian magazine, explains, Imams have very different status in Shi'i and Sunni Islam.
You find in Shia also that the Imams have a sort of inspiration, if not revelation, and they can state and establish also rules of law on something like this. That's a fact, while they are just pious people or good people in Sunnah. They are highly respected, but they haven't any legislative power.
Shi'i Islam also differs from Sunni Islam in an important psychological aspect, because temperamentally it speaks for the underdog, the oppressed, and the dispossessed. This can be traced directly back to the Shia's vain opposition to the Umayyad dynasty, and more importantly, to the massacre or martyrdom of Husayn at the Battle of Karbala in 680, where Umayyad armies routed the Shias. The martyrdom of Husayn is an event ever present in the minds of Shias. It is celebrated by them in passion plays and penitential processions, especially in Iran and Iraq, the two most strongly Shi'i countries. In the West, we often compare the divisions between Sunni and Shia Muslims with the schism in Christianity between Catholic and Protestant. Abu Bakr Baghdadi is Deputy Secretary General of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Baghdadi thinks the West has distorted and exaggerated the difference between Sunni and Shias.
Usually, cultures like to compare things as they are in their society. Now, do you think the difference between Republicans and Democrats, and don't laugh, is that serious in the...
It's not a religious...
No, I'm saying because the difference between Sunni and Shi'i Islam is almost a difference in a single political issue. Who is to be the Imam? The Shia saying it is something dictated from the Almighty. And they have a whole theory based on that. The Sunnis say no. It is a figure subject to the election of the community. And but yet, the single differentiating idea is this political issue. Who governs?
While Baghdadi's optimism may reflect the situation in the Islamic world at large, the differences at a social and political level are very real in a few areas, particularly in the Gulf states. Fuad Zakaria is an Egyptian philosopher now living in Kuwait.
I have the feeling that the division between Sunni and Shia is very important, and that sometimes people might forget all the other areas of life in order just to remember that this man is a Shia or this man is a Sunni. For instance, you might have some common interest with another man, but the moment you know that he is a Shia, you would forget all that and you would remember that he belongs to the other sect. I noticed this in many cases here in the Gulf area.
I asked Zakaria about marriages between Sunni and Shias in the Gulf.
Very rare. No Shia would marry a Sunni woman and vice versa, no. Except in very rare cases, and those are frowned upon in society. But in my own country, of course, this division is not known. And if you ask the man in the street what a Shia means, he wouldn't be able to tell you. He wouldn't be able to know that he himself is a Sunni, because everybody is a Sunni. So he doesn't call himself by this name.
Just as Fuad Zakaria had never been aware of the differences between Sunni and Shia while growing up in Egypt, so Wada Faris, an Iraqi who spent most of his adult life in Lebanon, only became conscious of the difference when the political situation began to worsen in that country.
We never grew in our homes. Even some friends, you know, we never recognized Sunni from Shia till the late 60s. We never know, we didn't know what the difference was. Until you are confronted with political and social upheavals that pushed you to a corner where you defined yourself.
For Fatih Osman, the doctrinal similarities outweigh the differences.
The difference between Shi'i and Sunni is still a fact. In the present situation, which the intellectuals in both parties are trying to bridge, but the gap is a fact, and the historical accumulation of incidents add to the barriers between the Sunnis and the Shi'is. But if you explore the real principles of the two parties, they rely on Quran, and the Quran is the same.
It is not that Shias read another Quran. It is the same Quran. It is not that Shias make a different Hajj. It is the same Mecca where they go for Hajj. It is not that the Shias make a different kind of prayer. They pray in the same manner as Sunnis pray. It is not that Shias don't fast and Sunnis fast.
While the differences should not be exaggerated, no one can claim that they really don't exist. As a rule of thumb, the further one travels away from the Gulf and the Shia heartland, the less visible the differences become. Perhaps one can conclude that in many instances, theological differences have been used to justify social, political, and international disputes. We'll leave the last word with Mohammed Sakhar, a Palestinian living in Amman, Jordan, and a former member of the Muslim Brothers.
There are some narrow-minded Sunnists and so many narrow-minded Shias, but the real spirit of Islam is the same. One God, one prophet, one book. And even in the Sunnists, you have different approaches. We have the jurists, the four schools of thought. I mean, so when a knowledgeable man goes deep, he will find no real difference between the Shi'ites and the Muslims.
Or accept that there is a hierarchy and an intercessor between Allah and the people.
But in the real belief, the real tenets of Islam, no one differs.
Muhammad and His Heirs was written and produced by Julian Crandall Hollick. The program was introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings. The technical producer was Peter K. Storkerson, and the rebroadcast producer was Dean Capello. The music consultant was Brian Silver of International Music Associates. Consultants to this program were Professors William Graham of Harvard University, Frederick Denny of the University of Colorado, and Khurshid Ahmed of the Islamic University in Islamabad, Pakistan. The World of Islam is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, in cooperation with WBUR Boston, and is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Mark Schilling. If you'd like to comment on this program or to order cassette copies and transcripts, please phone area code 508-486-9180 or fax number 508-486-9652 during regular business hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.